coronavirus infections in Israeli jails and the medical negligence of Israeli-Palestinian prisoners' conditions, the Palestinian Legislative Council, along with the Ministry of Palestinian Prisoners, held a press conference to express concerns of the serious condition of the prisoners at Israeli jails. Palestinians demanded an urgent action from the international community to save their life.
Our prisoners are dying inside the Israeli jails as the Israeli regime is practicing a slow death policy against them. The Israeli regime doesn't provide the infected prisoners with the required medical care. The international community should step in to save our prisoners' lives.
According to Palestinian Prisoners Organization, over 250 prisoners are diagnosed with the coronavirus, and the number is expected to rise due to the intentional medical neglect at Israeli jails, as Israel has stalled delivery of the vaccine to the Palestinian prisoners. Palestinians also demanded an international supervision to vaccinate the Palestinian prisoners and make sure they are delivering the required health care.
Palestinian prisoners are facing a serious danger that threatens their lives. Israel is using this virus against our prisoners to put further pressure on them. The coronavirus has already reached a number of Israeli jails and infected almost 250 Palestinian prisoners.
Palestinian sources say over 5,000 Palestinians are currently detained in Israeli jails, mostly with no charge. Palestinian resistance has warned that they won't remain silent and hold Israel responsible for the consequences of neglecting the health condition of Palestinian prisoners.
The prisoners' issue is among our top priorities, and we will do our best to set our Palestinian inmates free. The resistance holds the Israeli regime responsible for all the consequences of this dangerous move.
Palestinian detainees have continuously resorted to open-ended hunger strikes in an attempt to express their outrage at the detention.
While some 5,000 Palestinian inmates are suffering in Israeli jails amid the coronavirus pandemic, Israel has deprived them from their right to health care. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden has marked the start of his presidency by signing a flurry of executive orders on a suite of issues, including COVID-19, the environment, immigration, and ethics. Some of the executive actions undo significant actions from Donald Trump's administration, including halting the travel ban from Muslim-majority countries and ending the declaration of a national emergency used to justify funding of construction of a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Sam Levine. The piece is titled Joe Biden Marks Start of the Presidency with Flurry of Executive Orders. Stay with us for more of Sam Levine's article. President Joe Biden has marked the start of his presidency by signing a flurry of executive orders on a suite of issues including COVID-19, the environment, immigration, and ethics. Some of the executive actions undo significant actions from Donald Trump's administration, including halting the travel ban from Muslim-majority countries and ending the declaration of a national emergency used to justify funding construction of a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border. Joe Biden also signed an order allowing the United States to rejoin the Paris Climate Agreement and end the Trump administration's efforts to exclude undocumented immigrants from the census data used to determine how many seats in Congress each state gets. The president also moved quickly to address COVID-19, signing orders to mandate wearing of face masks and social distancing in all federal buildings and lands, and to create a position of a COVID-19 response coordinator. In other moves, Joe Biden also revoked the permit granted for the controversial Keystone XL pipeline and instructed all executive agencies to review executive actions that were damaging to the environment or unsupported by the best available science. Biden also ordered all executive branch employees to sign an ethics pledge and place limits on their ability to lobby the government whilst he is in office. The new president also ordered federal agencies to review equity in their existing policies and come up with a plan in 200 days to address inequality in them. First day in office, President Biden signed 17 executive actions, 15 will be executive orders. As he began signing the orders, Biden, wearing a face mask and seated behind the Resolute desk, said, "I think some of the things we're going to be doing are bold and vital, and there's no time to start like today." It's not unusual for an incoming president to take executive action immediately after being sworn into office, a movement to show the nation that the newly inaugurated president is getting to work. But the breadth and volume of Joe Biden's immediate executive orders underscores how quickly the new president intends to move in addressing the COVID-19 pandemic and turning the page from the Trump administration. These executive actions will make an immediate impact in the lives of so many people in desperate need of help. Wade Henderson, the interim president and chief executive officer of the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, said in a statement. Wade Henderson added, "Reversing Donald Trump's deeply discriminatory Muslim ban, addressing the COVID-19 crisis, preventing evictions and foreclosures, and advancing equity and support for communities of color and other underserved communities are significant early actions that represent an important first step in charting a new direction for our country." A flurry of activity from Joe Biden came on the same day that Democrats formally took control of the U.S. Senate, as Reverend Raphael Warnock and John Ossoff were formally sworn in as the two senators from Georgia. Chuck Schumer, the Democratic senator from New York, is now the Senate Majority Leader, whilst Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky Republican, is now the Minority Leader in the Senate. Speaking from the Senate floor, Chuck Schumer was momentarily breathless, saying, "We have turned the page to a new chapter in the history of our democracy, and I'm full of hope." Mitch McConnell, in his first remarks as the minority leader, also focused on a message of unity. McConnell said, "Our country deserves for both sides, both parties, to find common ground for the common good everywhere we can, and disagree respectfully where we must." The people intentionally trusted both political parties with significant power to shape our nation's direction. He also praised Kamala Harris's historic achievement after she was sworn in as America's first female vice president. All citizens can applaud the fact that this new three-word phrase, Madam Vice President, is now a part of our American lexicon, Mitch McConnell said. Looming on the horizon is a second impeachment trial for Donald Trump, who the House of Representatives voted to impeach earlier this month. In addition to the COVID-19 relief, Democrats are also expected to push legislation dealing with immigration reform and also voting rights. Even though Democrats have a majority of votes in the Senate, they still face significant obstacles to get them through. That's because Senate rules require 60 votes to overcome a filibuster. A filibuster is a procedural move that can be used to halt legislation. Some progressives have called for ending the practice, which would allow Democrats to pursue sweeping legislation without Republican support. But it is unclear if the party will do that.
European News Bulletin.
I'm Saeed Pereza. Ethnic minorities in the UK are significantly less likely to take the coronavirus vaccine than their white counterparts. According to the Scientific Advisory Group for Emergencies, or SAGE, vaccine hesitancy is highest among black British groups, with 72% stating they would be very unlikely to get the jab. The report added that Pakistani-Bangladeshi groups are the second most reluctant, with 42% saying they're very unlikely to be inoculated. This despite the fact that ethnic minorities are much more susceptible to being diagnosed with coronavirus, as they're more likely to work in risky frontline jobs, such as retail and transport. Meanwhile, a doctor working with COVID-19 patients in a London hospital has said his workplace feels like a war zone. Dr. Amir Wahid said healthcare workers were being stretched as the number of people in the UK suffering from coronavirus is increasing every day. On Wednesday, the UK recorded over 1,820 deaths in 24 hours, the highest number of fatalities in a single day since the pandemic began. For more on that, I'm joined by Dr. Ranjit Barar. He is an NHS consultant, physician, and surgeon. Good to see you as always, Dr. Barar. So why do you think ethnic minorities are so resistant to getting the COVID vaccine?
Thank you. Good to be with you. I do think it's cruel, as you say, it's an irony. The ethnic minority population here, Afro-Caribbean population in particular, are amongst the most susceptible, the most likely to have poor outcomes, highest mortality rate. And initially, when we talked about this earlier in the pandemic, we questioned whether there was a genetic susceptibility. We now know that that is not the case, that this is a socioeconomic phenomenon. This is because this section of the population, whilst imperialism is now very keen to paint itself in rainbow colors. We don't. Britain is an imperial country, but no longer displays an overt racism in its outward propaganda. But where that systemic racism shows up is in the life chances, in the economic group into which you're more likely to find yourself packaged if you are from a non-white ethnic minority, from an immigrant population. That is the reason why ethnic minorities, Afro-Caribbean, South Asian population are having higher susceptibility, higher rates of virus, because as you say, they're on the front line in lower paid jobs, more likely to be exposed and more likely to live in multi-generational households, more likely to therefore get the virus, more likely to do poorly from the virus. And it's for the same reason that actually these groups have experienced systemic discrimination in our society, and they have systemic mistrust towards almost all institutions. They see it at school, they see it from the prison service, they see it from the police, They see it from the justice system. They're more likely to go to jail. They're less likely to receive good educational outcomes from school.
And I'm afraid that Dr. Barrar, you watch the media here, and they're pinning it down to, for example, the pace at which the rollout took place. Some are saying probably this has got to do with people listening to conspiracy theories, especially on social media. What do you think?
I think there's systemic distrust towards our government and our media. There was a recent poll of who was the most trusted and least trusted professions in society. Nurses were the most trusted, having about 90% of the population trust them. Doctors, 87%. Politicians and journalists are below estate agents in our country. They have a kind of 10, 11, 12% of the population believe what they're saying. We've seen systemic levels of corruption, really amounting to fraudulent corruption. Hundreds of billions being spent on bailing out businesses, $5-6 billion on track and trace system that manifestly hasn't worked, $45 billion on testing. All of this leads to a systemic distrust of the government and the media, and especially high amongst those sections of the population who traditionally are not represented and not well served. And this is the problem, really. There's a mistrust in the official sources of information, and then people will turn to unofficial sources of information. That's a phenomenon we're seeing across the country, across Europe, even amongst medical professionals in France and Spain. There's a high levels of mistrust of this vaccine precisely because of the improper financial relationship between the large drug multinationals and governmental institutions. That doesn't mean that we should mistrust the fact that COVID exists. It doesn't mean we should mistrust the vaccine, but I'm afraid that's almost an inevitable outcome of the relationship currently between big business and our government.
And perhaps one way to build trust with the public would be to be more transparent on the part of the government. Dr. Ranjit Barrar, thank you and have a good evening. Staying in this country, Britain's National Health Service, which offers free care, health care to rich and poor alike, is in crisis. Privatization is turning patients into clients and prioritizing profits. Since the start of the pandemic, Britons have been urged to protect the NHS. But campaigners say the British government, not the pandemic, is the healthcare system's worst enemy. Bianca Rahimi tells us more.
The COVID-19 pandemic has thrown into stark relief what has been going on behind the scenes of a treasured British institution. The National Health Service has been reduced to a shadow of its former self by defunding and privatization. The NHS entered the pandemic with a demoralized workforce. Because of new contracts forced through by the government, healthcare professionals have fewer protections, privatization has led to fewer resources, and staff are actually leaving the NHS, tired of working under what Dr. Gill says are horrendous conditions.
NHS staff feel undervalued. Their terms and conditions of employment, their wages have stagnated since the 2008 crash. In real terms, 15 to 20% pay cut. And under those circumstances, it's very difficult to keep hold of staff. And then we've had the whole Brexit affair, which has alienated European staff.
Before the pandemic hit, the NHS had vacancies for 40,000 nurses and 10,000 doctors. The Tory government is being accused of failing to introduce basic healthcare measures and using the hurried rollout of vaccines to turn the media's attention away from its shortcomings.
We should not be in a third wave. We should never have ever approached tens of thousands of people dying because the government didn't act to save life. It acted to serve business interests, but ideologically they are not in government to save life. They're in government to further the profits of corporations. And, you know, human life is not valued by this government.
At the start of the pandemic, the opposition Labour Party called on ministers to publish the conclusions of a cross-government pandemic drill called Cygnus that took place in 2016. It accurately predicted that a deadly flu-like disease would plunge the NHS into crisis with a severe shortage of personal protective equipment, intensive care beds, and ventilators.
The drill painted a bleak picture, and only 4 years later, almost all those predictions have come true, with the death toll across the UK approaching 100,000. Bianca Rahimi, London.
We turn away from the UK now. The Biden administration is proposing a five-year extension to the new START treaty, limiting the number of US and Russian strategic nuclear weapons.
National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan will convey the extension proposal to Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Anatoly Antonov. The move is considered an early signal of Biden's intent to pursue arms control and was welcomed by both Russia and key American allies. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has already called on both countries to extend and broaden the treaty. Israeli businessman Benny Steinmetz has spent 2 weeks on trial in Geneva in a case described as the mining sector's biggest ever corruption case. Steinmetz is accused of bribing public officials in the West African country of Guinea in order to gain control of the country's iron ore deposits. Steinmetz denies the charges. The case dates back to 2006 when the prosecution alleges the businessman bribed to the tune of $10 million so his company could acquire sole mining rights.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Should you have to pay more than twice for coronavirus vaccines if you haven't paid into the research that led to their development? Well, that's what South Africa, the continent's worst-hit country, is being asked to do. Ahmed Kabbala joins me with all the details. Ahmed, good evening.
Good evening, Saeed. Yeah, this story has angered many people, particularly when you look at the history of South Africa and Oxford University. Now, Oxford University has one of its most famous alumni as Cecil Rhodes, whose statue sits outside of Oriel College. Now, Cecil Rhodes made his huge fortune through rape, pillage of the Southern African region, which included South Africa, Northern Rhodesia, and Southern Rhodesia, which are today called Zambia and Zimbabwe. And many think it's hypocritical for an Oxford vaccine developed by the Oxford University to charge South Africa, a country which had been it's indebted to so much for a vaccine, more than its European counterparts that have not contributed to the building of Oxford University like South Africa. Now, these tweets from Global Justice Now speak to this. AstraZeneca, what happened to your promise to cap prices to provide COVID-19 vaccines to the widest population with as fair access as possible? And what we've seen through the COVID-19 pandemic is the divisions in society around the world have been exposed. In Palestine, we're seeing a vaccine apartheid being carried out by the Israeli regime. In the UK, we see ethnic minorities disproportionately affected. And now we're seeing the continent, which has been raped and pillaged more than anywhere else, being neglected once again when it comes to the distribution. Lisa Kane, final tweet on this story, says this: will a history professor from the University of Oxford please educate AstraZeneca on Rhodes and on colonialism?
Right, and it completely disregards what the WHO Secretary General had to say, that the priority must be to vaccinate some people in all countries rather than all the people in some countries. Let's move on to South America, Latin America, if you will, and what the U.S. is going to be doing as regards Venezuela and its fake president, Juan Guaido.
Yes, in the liberal mainstream media, we've seen a lot made of the differences between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. But when it comes to foreign policy, we here, with this story, see how much aligned Joe Biden's administration is and will be to Donald Trump's administration, particularly when it comes to Latin America and Venezuela, where they've continued to support the recognition of Juan Guaido, a guy that has never been elected to high office as a so-called president, and continue with the approach of sanctions. So you've got this tweet from Joe Biden's official Twitter account that he put out in September before he was elected, indicating how it was not going to change. He says, as Juan Guaido speaks about the Venezuelan humanitarian crisis and the crimes against humanity, perpetrated by Maduro, I reaffirm my commitment to stand with the Venezuelan people. A Biden-Harris administration will always champion democracy and human rights around the world. Now, Chris Williamson, a former Labour MP, says, Biden continues where Trump left off. Whoever's in the White House, nothing changes. The US continues to be an anti-democratic, imperialist empire that poses a threat to peace around the world. Viva Venezuela. And final point on this, we've heard a lot made of the Capitol riots and the threat to democracy that Donald Trump has supposedly represents. But the US is the greatest threat to democracy and stability around the world, and it's proven that by continuing to support an unelected puppet that has never stood for any presidential elections.
All right, Press TV's Ahmed Caballo with those stories.
As well as most other social media platforms, following claims from the companies in question that he had incited the violence witnessed at the U.S. Capitol. However, as many rejoiced at the news that Trump was being deprived of his platform to deliver his many hateful views, others warned of the precedent now set for anti-establishment figures and news outlets. Following the incident, much praise was leveled at social media giants for their collective move to silence Donald Trump on their platforms, especially those aligned with the U.S. Democratic Party. However, this seemingly small win for left-wingers on social media was quickly met with sharp criticism from those outside of the United States. German Chancellor Angela Merkel was perhaps the most high-profile figure to have spoken out against Twitter, citing the move as problematic and a violation of fundamental rights to free speech. The German leader was not alone on the global scene, with the UK Premier Boris Johnson calling for a real debate to take place on the issue of social media freedoms, as the Polish government plans to make censoring social media accounts illegal. But beyond the mainstream debates on the issue, what is perhaps more important is to discuss what the real result of Trump's social media ban has paved the way for. The first issue that was almost completely ignored by those advocating for the ban was the prospect of the ban itself causing a further radicalization of Trump supporters. President Donald Trump has, since the election results were announced, been claiming on a daily basis that the election was a sham and that there was widespread voter fraud. This issue had even gotten to such a point that Trump loyalists were willing to abandon their traditional home at right-wing channels such as Fox News for simply acknowledging that Joe Biden was president-elect. The second major issue with the censoring of Trump and many of his supporters on social media has been that big tech companies have begun to come after anyone now that doesn't have the Western mainstream establishment line. This has resulted in the targeting of Press TV's official Facebook page, which built up a following of almost 4 million people, along with the targeting of many prominent anti-war voices. Let's be clear, what happened at the U.S. Capitol was violent and in no way representative of the so-called peace-loving democracy concept that the United States loves to market to the rest of the Western world. But despite this, the U.S. president has been getting away with directly inciting violence throughout his presidency, including during the 2020 BLM protests when he instructed police via Twitter to use excessive force. If this move was truly about ending calls from leaders, which could be interpreted as inciting violence, then why was Trump's account able to remain all throughout last year? Also, why was Trump able to threaten Iran openly over Twitter, claiming that he would violate international law by striking 52 sites, including cultural targets? Finally, if this move was an act on compassionate grounds by social media companies, then why are the accounts of Barack Obama and George Bush still around? War criminals, literal coup leaders, murderers, and convicted sex offenders are allowed to have access to social media platforms. If these companies are consistent, isn't it time for them to take down virtually every single Western leader from their outlets? Because if they are so opposed to the incitement of coups, Britain, France, the US, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Israel should all have their leaders purged.
More stories in this segment, starting with Thursday's deadly twin blasts in central Baghdad that was claimed by Daesh terrorists. The country's prime minister has vowed an earth-shattering response. Robert Carter has been following that story for us, and he joins me now to tell us what's happening in Iraq. Good evening, Robert.
Thanks, Saeed. So obviously, I'm sure everyone's seen the news. Twin deadly suicide bombing attack hitting the capital there in Baghdad, targeting a civilian area, a marketplace in the busy capital streets. And of course, well over 30 people killed, many others injured. It's just become commonplace in Iraq, unfortunately, these types of incidents. And you know, with the news that Daesh is still active in Iraq, it of course causes massive concern. The Iraqi government has of course promised a strong response. The Prime Minister has vowed not to allow further incidents like this to happen again, and the government has held emergency meetings on finding ways to discuss how they can improve the security situation in Iraq. But ultimately, what's caused a lot of anger online is the fact that Joe Biden has only just entered into the White House.
And Robert, before you move on, some are saying that all of this is happening. This is like some kind of a fight between the different political groups ahead of the elections in the country. Others, as you yourself said earlier on, this was something that was carried out by Daesh that is said to be resurgent in Iraq. They're probably not in the rural areas at the moment, but they are coming back.
Well, that's what a lot of people are saying, is that, you know, could there be some kind of Daesh revival in the country? And now that the new U.S. president is in, it seems as if his solution to this pending threat is to send more U.S. troops back to the country. And that's something that we know the Iraqi people certainly don't want. And that has been reflected on social media as well, Saeed. Let's go to the first tweet. I can actually bring it up now. It's from Khalid Baydoun, who says, prayers, of course, with the victims of the bombings in Baghdad. The Daesh claimed bombings killed 32 people and injured 100 plus more. Why isn't this getting more media coverage? Because the victims of terror are Muslim, Arab, and poor. And then Hadi Nasrallah brings up the point I've mentioned, which is a day after Biden became president, two horrific suicide attacks targeted civilians in a busy market in Baghdad. Now Biden wants to send more troops to Iraq. Surprise, surprise. Lest we forget that Biden was essential in the destruction of Iraq and the rise of Daesh to begin with. I think that ultimately is a vital point that needs to be mentioned more.
All right, let's move on to your second story, if we can. And that's got to do with French atrocities in Algeria before 1962, when they gained independence. The French are saying they acknowledge it, that war crimes took place, but they don't think it was brutal enough to warrant an apology.
Yes, absolutely. So Macron, of course, is not really within the Muslim world's good books as of last year, when he essentially launched an anti-Muslim crackdown inside France's borders. But one ongoing bloody legacy of France is its imperialist conquests in Muslim lands. And of course, the war for independence in Algeria was just one of the darkest periods in French history, where essentially millions of Algerians were butchered by French occupation forces. And decades later, that still resonates within Algerian society today. Now, Macron has essentially, when asked, admitted that he has no plans to apologize at all for the crimes.
Well, Robert, let me interrupt you there, but why is he not apologizing? I mean, he's not the only president who is not doing it. Successive French presidents, from Jacques Chirac to Sarkozy to Hollande, they all stopped short of issuing a formal apology. They've only said they acknowledge the fact that brutalities happened during those years.
It's difficult to say. There could be many factors in this. Of course, France is, if you look at the voting record, there is a rise in far-right sentiment, anti-immigration sentiment, anti-Muslim sentiment in the French electorate. If Macron was to appease Algeria in this sense, then it's quite likely that his support base could take a real hit as right-wing voters turn away from Macron, who perhaps would be seen as too pro Algeria, too pro-Muslim, too pro-minority from this move. Mm-hmm. So he's turned very right-wing over the past couple of years. But also, if he issues an apology for this, what comes next. Algeria will surely demand reparations. I'm sure there'll be other minorities and other countries which France is devastating.
That is a very valid point, Robert. Let's let social media users weigh in on this as well.
Absolutely. So some very important points being raised. First, from Impact UK, which is a UK-based Muslim advocacy group, they say France will not apologize. Well, France doesn't just need to apologize. They need to pay back all the wealth that they stole. So pushing for reparations there. And then Ben Norton, a journalist based in the US, comes in saying, in Algeria's war for independence against 120 years of colonialism, France killed 1 million Algerians, sent 2 million more to concentration camps, and tortured countless. But neoliberal President Macron declares there will be no apology. And I think that that sums up the whole story here. The very least the Algerians need are reparations. I don't think they particularly want an apology.
Right, Robert Carter with those stories. Robert, thanks a lot. I'm afraid that's all the time we have for this broadcast.
From east to west, throughout the vast land of Iran, you're listening to IRIB English Radio. The limelight.
According to the European Union and Spanish government figures, although irregular crossings to Europe dropped overall in 2020, the Canary Islands routes saw a significant rise, with some 22,600 migrants arriving, making Spain the main point of entry for migrants trying to reach European shores last year. At least 600 people died or disappeared trying to make the journey. The resurgence of the route has been driven in part by COVID-19. The pandemic has wiped out livelihoods across Morocco by cutting off tourism revenue and periodically shutting down local businesses. Whilst in the past, most arrivals in the Canaries were from sub-Saharan Africa, now about half are Moroccans. We have prepared for you an article written by Musa'ab Al-Sahami, titled Boats Emerge from Sahara Sand to Transport Migrants to Spain. The article was published on AssociatedPressNews.com website. Please stay with us for more of Musa'ab Al-Sahami's article. Beneath a star-packed sky in the Sahara, smugglers and handymen unearth a boat buried in the sand, a made-to-order vessel for carrying migrants from North African coast to Spain's Canary Islands. With seasoned skill, the men hoist the blue-bottomed wooden boat atop a four-wheel drive vehicle that will take it from this inland hideaway to the Western Sahara's shores. From there, the boat is meant to take 20 to 30 migrants into the Atlantic Ocean and across what the European Union's border agency calls the most dangerous migratory route in the world. The boat handover is a crucial but little-seen piece of migrant smuggling, chain in the disputed Western Sahara, a business that thrived last year as the coronavirus pandemic plunged many Africans into poverty, and with other routes choked off, migration to the Canary Islands jumped eightfold to their highest rates ever recorded. Encouraged by purported aid from Spain and the European Union, the Moroccan authorities who control Western Sahara, where some residents have long sought independence, are increasingly cracking down and thwarted a recent boat transfer witnessed by the Associated Press. But many others succeed as smugglers dodge police helicopter searchlights in the desert and reach fishing towns on the coast around Dakhla. The peninsula city boasts a thriving fishing port, and kitesurfing enthusiasts flock to its waters. But in recent months, its beaches have become a hotspot for smuggling networks eyeing the Canary Islands, 500 kilometers to the north. According to the European Union and Spanish government figures, although irregular crossings to Europe dropped overall in 2020, the Canary Islands route saw a significant rise, with some 22,600 migrants arriving, making Spain the main entry point for migrants trying to reach European shores last year. At least 600 people died or disappeared trying to make the journey to the Canary Islands. The resurgence of the route has been driven in part by COVID-19. The pandemic has wiped out livelihoods across Morocco by cutting off tourism revenue and periodically shutting down local businesses. Whilst in the past most arrivals in the Canaries were from sub-Saharan Africa, now about half are Moroccans. According to the International Organization for Migration, IOM, boats are routinely set out from the West African shores of Guinea, Gambia and Mauritania. A resident of Dakhla, who organizes trips for migrants, said economic difficulties drove him to work for a smuggling network. The 32-year-old told the Associated Press, on condition of anonymity, because what he does is illegal, he said, "We had to make money and feed our families." He says he puts together one trip per week, while competitors send out up to 10 boats a night. He estimates as many as half of the migration attempts fail, either because of problems before departure or because of problems at sea. One recent failure was visible on the shores of Dakhla Peninsula, the freshly charred remains of a migrant boat that caught fire. The fate of those on board the boat is unclear. IOM, the International Organization for Migration's Missing Migrants Project, provisionally recorded 601 deaths or disappearances on the Canary route last year, including at least 109 who left from Dakhla or were found near Dakhla. They are still investigating another 8 missing boats, with 355 individuals on board. The Dakhla resident said migrants paid $2,000 for the trip, a vast sum in Morocco, but the typical worker earns just a few hundred dollars a month, but wouldn't say how much he earns himself. He said, "I don't know where they get the money from, but they want to leave at any cost." One recent night, a group of smugglers left Dakhla and headed inland, followed by a vehicle carrying a dozen handymen. They drove past police checkpoints, they turned off their highway into the endless expanse of desert. The driver had a global positioning system, GPS coordinate on a phone, and crossed the sand with the experience of someone who seemed to have taken the route many times. At the meeting point, the men found a white tent and a young boat builder and unearthed a large boat. Just as they prepared to head back, the smugglers received a message about police movement and were told to leave the boat. Within minutes, the vessel was deep beneath the sand again, and the tent and equipment gone. As the men drove back towards town, police stopped their car and searched it for signs of smuggling, but found none. The carpenter said he built the boat in the desert to avoid attracting attention. A common practice, those smugglers are sometimes simply buy boats from fishermen. The carpenter, who said he earns about 20,000 dirhams or $2,000 per vessel, spoke on condition of anonymity because of the connection to smuggling networks. When such boats make it to Dakhla, they find plenty of takers. Take up to 4 days to get to the Canary Islands, and people arrive in terrible shape. According to migration agencies, they generally don't take food on the journey, and very little water, if any. But deterring people from taking the risk is a huge challenge in a global economic crisis. As crossings surged last year to the highest level since European Union Border Agency began collecting data in 2009, Spain sent top government officials to Senegal and Morocco in November to discuss how to stop the crossings. The European Union claims it provided development aid to African countries to help them manage migration, and has also claims it set up a €5 billion or $6 billion trust fund to address the problem. For its part, Moroccan police have said they prevented nearly 10,000 migrants from crossing to Europe last year, and the government agreed to take back Moroccans who are deported. But still, hundreds of people attempt the journey. Already 6 deaths have been recorded in 2021 on the Canary Island route. Most recently, a boy who drowned in the Atlantic Ocean. Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson told EU lawmakers recently, "It is absolutely one of the most deadly routes to the European Union," she added, "and we don't know exactly actually how many lives have been lost."
Africa Today.
Africa has hundreds of millions of hectares of uncultivated arable land. To utilize this great potential and tackle perennial hunger in the continent, the largest ever Food and Agriculture Organization Regional Conference for Africa was held in Zimbabwe last October. Speaking during the event, Zimbabwean presidents called for strong partnerships to boost agriculture in Africa.
The elimination of hunger affecting more than 750 million people in Africa, and the response to the different structural challenges we face as a continent requires strong partnerships.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place in Africa. Today, we are focusing on Africa's agriculture and asking, why has the continent failed to utilize its great potential in this sector? And in the second segment of our program, we are delving into the ongoing problem of racism in South Africa. We shall examine the reasons behind the unending racial tensions in South Africa. Stay with us till the end of our show.
What ails Africa's agriculture? According to estimates, Africa has around 600 million hectares of uncultivated arable land, almost 60% of the global total. And on the land that is being used, outdated technologies and techniques mean productivity is low. What really ails Africa's agriculture? In trying to answer this question, the largest ever the Food and Agriculture Organization Regional Conference for Africa was held in October last year in Zimbabwe. Ministers who attended committed to raise ambitions and accelerate actions towards achieving food security. Some remarks during the opening of the conference mentioned irrigation is a key in Africa's quest for food security.
We must therefore redouble our efforts to increase the effectiveness of modern water harvesting technologies and irrigation, especially in view of the need to improve agricultural yields to cater for the ever-increasing population of our continent.
Akinwumia Desina, the president of the African Development Bank Group, believes that for the full potential of agriculture to be realized in Africa, young people must change their approach and look at agriculture as a lucrative business.
And the millionaires of Africa, they are not going to come from oil and gas. They are going to come from agriculture as a business.
Several Western multinationals and organizations involved in Africa's agriculture have come under sharp criticism for exploiting farmers in the continent. One such example is the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, which entered Africa's agricultural sector through the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa. This foundation is blamed for having increased corporate agriculture's profits while local farmers continue languishing in poverty and hunger is rising. Now, for an incisive analysis on what ails Africa's agriculture, we have contacted Firoz Manji, an author, activist, and a professor of African studies at Carleton University in Canada. He's also a publisher at Daraja Press. Thanks a lot for your time, Professor. It's always great having you in our show. Now, most of the world's arable land is in Africa. Why have African countries failed to utilize this great potential to feed the world?
People such as Bill Gates, who have supported the AGRA, the Green Revolution in Africa, which was sort of set up, in 2006, have been trying to persuade our governments and pouring huge amounts of money into together with the Rockefeller Foundation to persuade farmers to invest in large-scale industrial farming, and secondly, to try and persuade farmers to stop producing food for what is needed, but rather to get into commodity production by the promotion of inputs such as fertilizers, seeds, which are controlled by people like Monsanto and Bayer.
Professor Firoz Manji there, thanks for that, and stay tuned for more.
Major agricultural projects in Africa are blamed for destroying the production of essential food crops in favor of cash crops and introduction of expensive chemical fertilizers and GMO seeds that are bankrupting small farmers. Many farmers are not happy at all with the invasion of their lands by multinationals, as this farmer in Malawi explains.
Ute mufune msafune ife basi tilima mzimbe ndefe dinadabwa kuti si kuti phera ufuru wathu kodi ife tikalima kuti popeza tili anthu ambiri mbiri ulimo wa mzimbe umangotenga munthu imodzi mahekita angapo pamene munhu mdera lathu tili anthu ambiri.
Back to you, Professor Manji. Now, can you elaborate on how the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation destroyed small-scale farmers who have fed the continent for centuries?
What has happened? It's been a huge investment into a failed project, and the purpose of all this money is essentially to imprison farmers into the agro-industrial complex, and that means that their people are trying to produce food or produce commodities rather. Which are for export and which are supposed to have increased their income. But the reality, it hasn't increased their income. In fact, many, many poor people are poor and impoverished and are dependent now on the inputs which AGRA and the Bill and Gates Foundation have done that.
Now, Professor Manji, Can you give us an example of where the policies of the Alliance for a Green Revolution in Africa, being funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, have impacted negatively on agriculture in Africa?
One looks at in Kenya, for example, where I'm from, you know, small-scale farms are not even allowed to decide for themselves which corn seeds they plant and what fertilizer they use and what pesticides they use on their fields. And it's the agrochemical companies like Monsanto, like Bayer, that make all these decisions for farmers. And Agra's focus is on a few food crops such as corn or soya, causing traditional nutrient-rich foods to be neglected and even displaced. And the statistics for the 13 Agra focus countries show that production of cereals has fallen by about 21% since the initiative was launched. A yield decline of 7% was recorded for root and tuber crops.
Thanks for that, Professor Manji, for your insight.
Another problem faced by farmers in Africa is that of subsidies. Western countries are also still subsidizing their farmers at the expense of developing nations, undermining market access for some of the world's poorest producers. For instance, the World Trade Organization failed to improve the plight of poor cotton farmers in African countries by getting the U.S. to cut its subsidies to cotton.
Now, earlier in our show, we heard Akinwumi Adesina, the president of the African Development Bank Group, saying that the youth in Africa should get involved in agriculture. Well, already many young people in the continent have realized the business potential in agriculture, as this young man in Rwanda explains. Let's take a listen.
My name is Giscard Tuishime. I started doing farming in 2012 by doing tomatoes, onions, street tomatoes, French beans, butternut squash for the local market.
Africa's population stands at approximately 1.2 billion people, and over 60% are below the age of 25. Now, this makes Africa the world's youngest continent. There is potential for agriculture to create employment. Now, what needs to be done to attract young people to agriculture? Well, you young people in Africa, let us know what you think, and we'll discuss it right here at Africa Today.
Racial tensions in South Africa.
Despite the end of apartheid in 1994, South Africa continues to witness racial tensions. The lingering complexities of race issues clearly show that the Rainbow Nation has to do much more to escape its violent past. Last November, South African police fired tear gas at opposition activists protesting against racism at a Cape Town school after a so-called whites-only year-end party was organized off-site, reportedly by parents.
Protesters targeted the Brackenfell High School, accusing it of not inviting black and mixed-race students to a private party that some pupils and their parents arranged after the school's official matriculation ball was canceled because of COVID-19. Marshall Dlamini, Secretary General of Economic Freedom Front, led the street protests against the alleged incident of racism.
We are no longer negotiating with racists. We meet them on the street and we defeat them on the street. That's why we're here today, to defeat them on the street.
At another incident in October, emotions ran high as two black suspects appeared in a South African court over the murder of a white farmer, which has once again sparked racial tensions, 26 years after the end of apartheid. The white farmers outside the courthouse in the town of Senekal said they were getting tired of all the murders.
We're here to stand our ground for farm murders. That's it. We're not here for the EFF or any political party for that matter.
Economic Freedom Fighters leader Julius Malema told a rally of supporters that many more black South Africans were victims of violent crime. He also insisted that white farmers are not being targeted in South Africa.
There are no white farmers being killed in South Africa.
In both incidents, President Cyril Ramaphosa issued statements expressing concern. Commenting on the school incident, he said the development brought back hurtful memories of a past we should never seek to